Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I'm a resident. This is episode 167 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this podcast, I'll be continuing our rapid review series for the USMLE Step 2 CK exam, but I'll be focusing on cardiology. So let's get right into it. So what if you get a question about a 75-year-old guy that passes out while he's mowing his lawn? What's your diagnosis? That's aortic stenosis, right? That'll be aortic stenosis. And what is your next best step in management or in diagnosis? Let's say maybe they tell you that on auscultation of the chest, you hear like a systolic ejection murmur that's radiating to the carotid, right? So you know obviously you're dealing with aortic stenosis, but since this is a valvular problem, what diagnostic step would you consider on your test? Well, I hope you're saying that you consider an echocardiogram, right? So, I mean, again, like I said, this guy clearly has aortic stenosis. And there are some key high yield things your friends at the MBA may expect you to know about aortic stenosis. First thing you want to know is, where is it heard best, right? It's heard best at the right upper sternal border. Another name for the right upper sternal border is essentially like the second intercostal space, okay, right by the sternum, right? So aortic stenosis, the thing is, also your friends at the MBME, they want you to know the Bosworth pathophysiology behind aortic stenosis, right? Where you have like a calcification of the valve, right? Remember, you want to be able to compare and contrast that with the Bosworth pathophysiology for mitral valve prolapse, which is myxomatous degeneration. And then you also want to compare that with the Bosworth pathophysiology for aortic dissection, which is cystic medial degeneration, or some key times you see it referred to as a cystic medial necrosis. So when a person has aortic stenosis, right, again, it's calcification of the valve. And one high yield thing you want to keep at the back of your mind is that prior to the age of 70, most people that have aortic stenosis have it because they have a bicuspid aortic valve. Okay, but past the age of 70, you just have like just regular good old calcification of the valve. So prior to the age of 70, you have calcification of a bicuspid valve being one of the more common causes of aortic stenosis, right? And one thing your friends at the MBME again want you to be able to do is they want you to be able to differentiate between aortic stenosis and hypertrophic obstructive cardiomyopathy. Both of these of those conditions have some very similar features. Right, they kind of sound similar, but they have some very key high yield subtle differences you want to keep at the back of your mind. The first one is more of a test taking thing, but that's just looking at the age of the person, right? Aortic stenosis will almost certainly be in an old person on an MBME exam. Hypertrophic obstructive cardiomyopathy will almost certainly be a young person on the MBME exam. Now, so let's talk about some key differences and compare them side by side, right? So aortic stenosis already said it's heard best at the right upper sternal border. Well, hypertrophic obstructive cardiomyopathy is different. It's actually heard best at the left lower sternal border. Okay, that's one. Second thing is that aortic stenosis, the murmur tends to be a systolic ejection murmur. That is actually the same thing with HOCM. HOCM is also a systolic ejection murmur. But unlike aortic stenosis that radiates to the carotids, the murmur of HOCM does not radiate to the carotids. That's a very important subtle difference to keep in mind. The murmur of HOCM does not radiate to the carotids. And the thing is, you probably remember I think it's Greek or Latin, right? Used to describe aortic stenosis as like pulsus parvus a tardus, right? So the tardus, right? Tardus means tardy. Tardy means late, right? So whenever a person has aortic stenosis, right, they will obviously have trouble getting blood out of the left ventricle. So if you feel like the PMI and then you feel their carotid pulse, you'll notice like, man, because if you try it on yourself right now, your PMI and your carotid pulse, they kind of like arrive at the same time. But if you notice that it's like your PMI, you can feel your heart beating, and then it takes a couple of seconds for you to feel like your carotid pulse. That means your carotid pulse is arriving late. So it's arriving tardily, right? That's why that's called pulsus parvus a tardus. The thing is, pulsus parvus a tardus is not observed in HOCM. Hokum goes more along the lines of something called pulsus bisferiens. Pulsus bisferiens, the bisferiens just means that you have a bifid carotid pulse. So what do I mean by a bifid carotid pulse? Essentially, you have a small carotid like pulse, and then it's followed up by a bigger one. Okay, that's the classic characteristic of Hokum. And then Hokum, one key thing to know about it is that Hokum tends to be like knowing what physical exam maneuvers modulate what. So the thing is, in aortic stenosis, if you increase preload, right? So let's say you squat, right? Or you go from a standing to a supine position, that will increase preload. If you increase preload, you'll put more blood in the left ventricle. If you put more blood in the left ventricle, there'll be more blood to eject through the stenotic aortic valve. So you'll have a louder murmur. So increasing any maneuver that increases preload will make the murmur of aortic stenosis louder. That's different for Hokum. The thing is, in Hokum, right? And again, I've talked about this ad nauseum in many other podcasts, so I'm not really going to go into a ton of detail here. But basically, with Hokum, you have something known as SAM, right? SAM just means a systolic anterior motion of the mitral, it's like systolic motion of the anterior mitral valve leaflet, right? So the thing is, whenever you, and that anterior mitral valve leaflet, when it moves forward, when it moves in systole, it tends to occlude the left ventricular outflow tract, right? And that will make the murmur of Hokum sound louder. But one way we can prevent the anterior leaflet of the mitral valve from occluding the LVOT, okay, the left ventricular outflow tract, is to put more blood in the left ventricle, okay? So the key thing you want, because many people tend to get confused by this, any maneuver that puts more blood in the left ventricle will make the murmur of Hokum sound softer. So essentially, if you have a situation where you have increased preload or increased afterload, that will make the murmur of Hokum sound softer, because increased preload will put more blood in the left ventricle. Increased afterload will prevent blood from being ejected from the left ventricle, right? So that's why the murmur will sound softer under those circumstances. So again, those are all high yield things to know. Versus, think about it, if a person has increased afterload, then there is less of a gradient for flow across the valve in aortic stenosis, so the murmur actually becomes softer. So again, I'll summarize. Increased preload makes the murmur of AS louder, the murmur of Hokum softer. Increased afterload makes the murmur of AS softer, and the murmur of Hokum softer. Very high yield to understand that. Now, how do we treat aortic stenosis, right? For the most part, you need to go ahead and replace the valve, right? Because remember, if people start having like anginal symptoms or like syncopal episodes or like heart failure symptoms, those people are knocking on death's door, right? They may die soon. Obviously, the one that's the worst is having heart failure symptoms versus having like syncopal symptoms versus having anginal symptoms, right? So you go ahead and you replace the valve. For Hokum, in general, right, you can implant a defibrillator, right, so that they don't get like nasty ventricular tachyarrhythmias that can kill them. But another thing you also do is to give them drugs that are negative inotropes, like beta blockers, because when you give a person a beta blocker, that will slow down the heart rate. And if you slow down the heart rate, the heart will spend more time in diastole. And if the heart spends more time in diastole, that means the left ventricle will fill with blood more, right? So you're essentially, again, preventing that dynamic LVOT obstruction by that anterior leaflet of the mitral valve. So under those circumstances, you can relieve those people's symptoms. So beta blockers are great. They're the first line medications for the management of Hokum. Now, remember, right, your other classic murmurs, right, like the buzzword descriptions, like mitral stenosis, right, obviously that's like the diastolic murmur, right? Heard best at the apex, right? Remember that other things you may see with mitral stenosis on your exam is like rheumatic fever. Remember, the biggest risk factor for mitral stenosis is rheumatic fever. And then remember that mitral stenosis, right, tends to also be the biggest. So rheumatic fever is the biggest risk factor for mitral stenosis. Mitral stenosis in and of itself is the biggest risk factor for AFib, because when a person has mitral stenosis, the left atrium has to contract against increased resistance. So that makes the left atrial wall dilate. And if the left atrial wall dilates, right, that can begin to create opportunities for AFib. And remember that as the left atrial wall dilates, that can compress the esophagus and that can cause dysphagia. That is one weird high yield thing you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. And then mitral regurg, right? Mitral regurg, remember that will be a holosystolic murmur heard best at the apex, okay, radiating to the axilla, right? And remember that mitral regurg, right, again, heard best at the apex. That's pretty much all you need to know about that. And then mitral valve prolapse, right, will be like the mid murmur heard best at the apex with a mid-systolic click. Classically, you'll find that in people with like connective tissue disorders like Marfan's, Ehlers-Danlos, ADPKD, so like autosomal dominant polycystic kidney disease, right? And again, you'll have that mid-systolic click, right? And again, the key principle you want to remember, because mitral valve prolapse and mitral regurg are a little different. They are both regurgitant murmurs, but maneuvers do different things to them, right? So in mitral regurg, if you increase preload, right, you'll put more blood in the left ventricle, so there'll be more blood available to regurgitate, so the murmur will actually sound louder. Now, if you increased afterload, right, again, there'll be more blood left behind in the left ventricle, and when there's more blood left behind in the left ventricle, there'll be more blood available to regurgitate, so that'll make the murmur sound louder. On the other hand, in mitral valve prolapse, the prolapsed valves, right, it's the prolapse of the valves that gives rise to the murmur. So if you can unprolapse the valves, then you will decrease the chance of the person having a murmur. And the key principle, because again, there are many ways that people go with this and then they get confused and then they say it's hard to memorize. But here's the one principle you want to remember. Anything that puts more blood in the left ventricle will unprolapse the valve. And if you unprolapse the valve, you will decrease the regurgitation. And if you decrease the regurgitation, the murmur will sound softer. So if you increase preload, that will put more blood in the left ventricle. That will unprolapse the valve and the murmur will sound softer. If you increase afterload, it will be difficult for blood to be ejected from the left ventricle. So more blood will stay in the left ventricle. That will also again unprolapse the valve and make the murmur sound softer. So I hope you understand that. And then aortic regurgitation, right? Remember, aortic regurg tends to occur in people that have, you know, like Marfan's, right? That's like a classic presentation. Or if a person, again, has like a thoracic aortic aneurysm, like a Marfan's person, an Ehlers-Danlos person, a Takayasu arteritis person, a person that has like syphilis, remember, tertiary syphilis tends to cause like an inflammation of the vasovisorum of the aortic arch. So that can cause an aortic aneurysm and that can cause a mitral regurg. Aortic regurg. Remember that aortic regurg, right, is generally associated with a wide pulse pressure. It's also kind of like the same deal with patent ductus arteriosus, also has a wide pulse pressure. If you see a wide pulse pressure, there's only two things you really should think about on your MBM exam. Think about, in terms of murmurs, think about a PDA, and that'll be a pediatric question, or think about aortic regurg. And remember that in aortic regurg, the aortic regurg, right, is the diastolic murmur, right, diastolic blowing murmur, heard best at the left lower sternal border, right? And it has like these weird things like the quinky pulse, head bobbing sign, right? Water hammer pulse, all that stuff, okay? And remember that aortic regurg, right, because the blood is regurgitating back into the left ventricle, you're essentially having chronic volume overload of the left ventricle. And when you have chronic volume overload of the left ventricle, that will, you know, sort of change the wall tension properties of the left ventricle, and that will cause a volume overload. That volume overload will give rise to eccentric hypertrophy, right, where you add sarcomeres in series. And whenever you have eccentric hypertrophy, you begin to introduce systolic dysfunction. So a person that has chronic aortic regurgitation will ultimately have heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. Contrast this with a person that has aortic stenosis, right? That will cause more of a pressure overload, and pressure overload gives rise to the addition of sarcomeres in parallel. Sarcomeres are added in parallel. And when you add sarcomeres in parallel, right, that decreases the luminal size of the left ventricle. So that causes diastolic dysfunction. So under those circumstances of concentric hypertrophy, the person will ultimately have heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. So again, those are all high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind with those murmurs. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that has like severe chest pain, right? Like severe sudden onset chest pain, and then they tell you that the chest pain is radiating to the person's back. What's your diagnosis under those circumstances? That's aortic dissection, right? The thing is, I just give you the classic presentation, but there are some other classic presentations your friends at the MBME love to present, right? So they may give you a question about a patient that has like sudden onset chest pain, and this patient has like differences in blood pressures between the arms. Whenever you see that, think about aortic dissection. Or if they show you an image and you see that the mediastinum is wider than normal, think about aortic dissection. Or they can describe a person that has like severe chest pain, and then they tell you that the on imaging the patient has a unilateral pleural effusion. If you see that, again, think about aortic dissection. And almost always, again, this is not always true, but I'll say like 80 to 90% of the time it's true. Whenever you get an aortic dissection question on the MBME exams, the person's blood pressure will be markedly elevated. Okay, it'll be markedly elevated. So how do you diagnose aortic dissection? If the patient is hemodynamically stable, set them for CT angiography, right? But if the patient is like hemodynamically unstable, you can do like a TTE. You do some kind of echocardiogram. You can do like a transthoracic, or if you're particularly facile, you can do a transesophageal echocardiogram. But really, for the most part, transthoracic will do, right? And the thing is, right, once you visualize the dissection, you essentially want to break it up into one of two things. Is it a type A dissection? So is it a Stanford type A dissection? Or is it a Stanford type B dissection? The reasoning behind that is, if you have a Stanford type, basically the thing that delineates those two groupings is involvement of the ascending aorta. Your decision tree basically should be, does this dissection involve the ascending aorta? If it does, it's a type A dissection. Your job is done. Okay, your job is done. Remember the A in Stanford type A for the A in ascending aorta, right? But if the dissection does not involve the ascending aorta, then it has to be a type B, okay? So just ask yourself the simple question, does it involve the ascending aorta? If yes, it's a type A. If no, it's a type B. And the reason you need to know those differences is that it helps you apportion your treatment appropriately, because when a person has a type A aortic dissection, right, for every aortic dissection, be type A, type B, you need to start first with a beta blocker, okay? You start with a beta blocker. It can be like propranolol, basically anything that's a beta blocker, even labetalol is acceptable for use on the MBME exams. But the thing you do beyond that is based on the type of aortic dissection you have. So if you have a type A dissection, in addition to giving the beta blocker, you need to proceed to surgery. But if you have a type B dissection, then you do not proceed to surgery. You can manage that medically. Okay? You can manage that medically. Now, when a person has aortic dissection, right? Again, remember the boss phrase I gave you, right? The boss phrase pathophysiology is the cystic medial necrosis, or in some circles is described as cystic medial degeneration. And what is the biggest risk factor for aortic dissection? That's hypertension. Hypertension is actually the biggest risk factor for aortic dissection. Now, one classic thing your friends on the MBME love to do is that they like to give you questions about aortic dissection and try to get you to choose like hydralazine as treatment. Do not choose hydralazine. The thing is, when a person has aortic dissection, you want to try to avoid increased heart rates, because increased heart rates will place more shear stress on the aortic wall and worsen the dissection. So if you give a person hydralazine, hydralazine is an arteriolar dilator. When you dilate those arterioles, that will decrease systemic vascular resistance, and that will cause your baroreceptors to cause a compensatory reflex tachycardia. And that reflex tachycardia, again, will cause more shear stress on the aortic wall, and that will worsen the dissection. So you don't want that. Okay, so that's why you give a beta blocker. Remember, beta blockers are negative inotropes, so they slow the heart rate down. So I think those are all the high yield things I want to say about aortic dissection. Now, what if they give you a question about an IV drug user, and this IV drug user for the last couple of weeks has been having like relatively high fevers, like 101, and this person has lost like 10 pounds of weight. And then they tell you that when you're auscultating this person's chest, you actually hear a murmur at the left lower sternal border. Okay, you hear a murmur, like a holosystolic murmur at the left lower sternal border. What are you thinking about under those circumstances? So think about this: IV drug user, chronic high fevers, new murmur. What is that? That's endocarditis, right? That's endocarditis. The thing is, endocarditis is a very high yield subject that's tested on the USMLE exams. So it's something you definitely want to know and know pretty well, right? And the thing is, if you suspect endocarditis, what is always your first step in diagnosis? You want to get a blood culture, right? You want to get a blood culture first, right? Typically, you would also obtain an echocardiogram. But if you had to pick one diagnostic test on your USMLE exam, go ahead and pick a blood culture initially. And then those patients need to be on IV antibiotics. You do the blood cultures, right? And then they need to be on IV antibiotics for a prolonged period of time. It's usually 6 weeks in the real world. So now let's talk about some ways they can present endocarditis to you, right? So what if they give you a question about endocarditis in an IV drug user? What kind of box should you be thinking about? Well, I hope you're telling me Staph aureus, right? Staph aureus is the most common cause, very high yield, is the most common cause of endocarditis in an IV drug user, right? And this Staph aureus endocarditis in an IV drug user will obviously affect the tricuspid valve, right? It usually affects the tricuspid valve, usually with tricuspid regurgitation. And you may say, Divine, why is it the tricuspid valve that is affected? Well, if you think about it, if you're an IV drug user, that means you're injecting the drugs into IVs, into veins, okay? And veins drain to the right side of the heart. So the first valve that will be encountered by the box you're injecting, because you're injecting drugs, will be the tricuspid valve. That is why the tricuspid valve is the most commonly involved valve in endocarditis in people that are IV drug users. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that has endocarditis, right? And they mention that this patient recently had a dental procedure. What box should you be considering? Well, I hope you're thinking about strep viridans under those circumstances. Remember, strep viridans, it tends to cause like a subacute endocarditis, especially if you have a valve that is already has like pre-existing issues. That places you at very high risk for endocarditis with a strep viridans. And typically the way you prophylax is you can give the patient oral amoxicillin, right? I mean, I think amoxicillin is only in the oral formulation. Ampicillin is the IV formulation of amoxicillin. So you give amoxicillin like a few hours before the procedure commences, okay, as antibiotic prophylaxis. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and this patient has culture negative, like they tell you that this patient has endocarditis, but you notice that blood cultures don't seem to be growing squat. One thing you should maybe try to think about on your exam is something called a coxiella. So coxiella bornerii is beginning to become a fairly common cause of endocarditis, especially when the blood cultures are negative. So that's just something to keep at the back of your mind. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient, you know, has like autoimmune hemolytic anemia or ITP or has like a Miller rash on the face and they have endocarditis? What should you be thinking about? I would really hope that under those circumstances, you're thinking about lupus and the Lippmann-Sachs endocarditis. Remember the mnemonic that SLE causes LSE, right? That will help you keep that straight on exams. Now, what if you get a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient has, you know, endocarditis and you get blood cultures and you notice that the blood cultures are growing strep bovis? What is your next step in management? Well, I would hope you're considering obtaining a colonoscopy, right? Because remember, strep bovis bacteremia has a very strong association with the coexistence of a colonic malignancy, right? So you need to perform a colonoscopy under those circumstances. Now, what if you get a question about a patient and this patient recently had a valve replacement and on this person's valve, especially let's say like, you know, like 70 days after the valve was placed in, they have like, you know, signs and symptoms of endocarditis. What book are you thinking about? Well, I hope you're seeing Staph epidermidis, right? Remember, Staph epidermidis makes biofilm. That's like a step one concept that may still pop up on the other USMLE exams. But Staph epidermidis, it makes biofilm, and that biofilm is very adherent to plastic surfaces. So that's why prosthetic valve endocarditis is usually caused on MBME exams by Staph epidermidis. And then, what if they give you a question about a patient that has endocarditis, and let's say 6 months ago, this patient immigrated from some kind of foreign developing country, and they tell you that, oh, this person had like an upper respiratory infection 2 years ago that resolved without treatment. What should you be thinking about under those circumstances? Well, I hope you're thinking about like rheumatic fever causing endocarditis, right? And remember that rheumatic fever is associated with group A strep infection, right? So strep pyogenes. So I think if you understand all these different permutations I just talked about, you should be golden from an endocarditis perspective. Now, what if they give you a question about a 75-year-old guy, and let's say this guy has smoked 2 packs of cigarettes every day for the last 50 years. And then this patient has been presenting with pain that is severe when he's walking to the YMCA that is about a block from where he lives. What diagnosis should you be thinking about under those circumstances? Well, I hope you're thinking about PAD, okay? I would hope you're thinking about peripheral arterial disease, right? And then if your friends at the MBME ask you for your next best step in diagnosis or in management, what would you want to do? Well, you want to go ahead and obtain an ankle brachial index, right? You want to go ahead and obtain an ABI. The thing is that ABI, the number you're looking for is a number less than 0.9. If you measure a person's ABI, so the ankle brachial index, and it's less than 0.9, that tells you that you're dealing with peripheral arterial disease. And once you confirm that a person has peripheral arterial disease, really the next thing you want to do is to put them on a supervised walking program, okay? That really does improve walking distance in a lot of people. But if, for example, that does not cut it, your next step in management on the exam is to add a drug, okay? You want to add a drug that has antiplatelet activity, but it's also a potent vasodilator. And this is the drug celostazol. Celostazol is a phosphodiesterase inhibitor. Remember, when you inhibit phosphodiesterase, that increases the amount of cyclic AMP in smooth muscle. And increased amounts of cyclic AMP in smooth muscle make the smooth muscle relax, okay? So that is why celostazol is good, because it can dilate the vessels that feed the lower extremities. Now, if, for example, that is not cutting it, then you need to consider performing some kind of bypass. But the thing is, before you perform the bypass, you need to do a vascular study to actually prove for sure that, you know what, this person has legit PAD, right? So typically for that, you perform something called an arteriography, okay? You perform something called an arteriography, and then you go ahead and send the patient for bypass for bypass surgery. Now, remember, right, that it's, you know, like if you have like occlusion of, like many people that have peripheral arterial disease, they have occlusion of like their femoral arteries or their popliteal arteries, okay? When people have femoral artery occlusions, they tend to have more of their pain in the thigh. When people have popliteal artery occlusions, they tend to have more of the pain in the leg, okay? Contrast this with Lerich syndrome, right? So Lerich syndrome will be a person that has like a lot of buttock pain, okay? And they'll tell you that this patient is impotent, having like marital problems because he cannot get it up with his wife. Under those circumstances, think about a variant of PAD known as Lerich syndrome. In Lerich syndrome, you essentially have PAD of your ureter and like the iliac branches, like the external iliac and the internal iliac. Again, these are all high yield things you need to know for your exam. And then, what is the biggest risk factor for peripheral arterial disease? What is the biggest risk factor for peripheral arterial disease? Well, I would really hope you're telling me that it's smoking, okay? Smoking is the biggest risk factor for peripheral arterial disease, okay? Smoking is the biggest risk factor for peripheral arterial disease. Again, that is something high yield your friends at the MBME expect you to know for exams. And then, one last thing I want to go ahead and say is, for some people, when you measure their ABI,
you're like, man, this person's EBA is like 1.5. When you see that, usually that's in a person that has a history of diabetes, okay? Now, being a person that has a history of diabetes, that condition is known as Munkerberg. So M-O-N-C-K-E-B-E-R-G. That's what's known as Munkerberg atherosclerosis. Typically, your next step in management for those people is to measure something known as the toe brachial index, okay? You measure the toe brachial index. When you measure the toe brachial index, that gives you a more accurate measure, right? Because the thing is, people that have diabetes, they may have calcified their blood vessels. So that gives you a falsely elevated EBI. Again, that's something very high yield you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient, you know, that has smoked for a long period of time, and then this patient has been complaining, like, over the last 30 minutes, he's been having, like, severe back pain and abdominal pain, and then they tell you that his blood pressure is really low and his abdomen is distended and you can feel a pulsatile mass. What's your diagnosis? Well, I would really hope that you're thinking about a ruptured triple A, okay? I would really hope that you're thinking about a ruptured triple A, right? So what is the biggest risk factor for a triple A? Well, it's smoking, right? Smoking is the biggest risk factor for an abdominal aortic aneurysm, right? And the thing is, when a triple A ruptures, that's bad, right? That's bad. The way you confirm the diagnosis of the rupture, I mean, you can do, again, CT angiography, but you can also do an ultrasound at the bedside, right? And then go ahead and send the patient to surgery. Now, one thing your friends at the MBA may kind of care about with a AAA is one that you know the screening guidelines, right? Remember, if you're a man, so women are not screened for AAA. If you're a man and you're over the age of 65 and you have a history of smoking, then you deserve a one-time abdominal ultrasound to screen for a AAA. If you have a AAA and the size is more than 5.5 centimeters, then it is recommended that you go ahead and fix the problem. But if the size of the AAA is less than 5.5, then you watch and wait. You watch essentially like every 6 months or every year. If it grows by 0.5 centimeter in 6 months or 1 centimeter in a year, then that person becomes eligible for repair. That's one high yield thing to know. Second high yield thing to know is that even if you've never smoked, if you have a family history of a AAA, then you deserve screening, especially if you're over the age of 50. If you're over the age of 50, and let's say you have like a first degree relative that has had a AAA, then that actually buys you screening as well, okay? Believe it or not, that's part of the guidelines. And that is something that, again, the USMLE loves to test. Now, so, you know, a AAA, you fix it, right? But the one thing your friends at the MBME kind of like you to know is to know the different complications that can arise when you're trying to fix a AAA, right? So one common one on exams is renal failure. In fact, like an AKI is probably one of the most common complications of fixing a AAA, okay? An AKI is probably one of the most common complications, right? Because again, most AAAs arise in the infrarenal aorta, right? So you're right around the renal artery, right? So that can cause like transient hypoperfusion of the aphridact of the renal artery during the case, and that can ultimately lead to an acute kidney injury. That's one. Second one is that if a person is having a AAA repair, right, remember that one thing that can happen is they can actually have problems with the spinal cord. They can infarct the spinal cord during the case, because the abdominal aorta gives rise to an artery. There's this famous artery known as the artery of Adamkiewicz. And the artery of Adamkiewicz gives rise to the anterior spinal artery for many levels of the spinal cord. So if they give you a question about a patient that becomes paraplegic or like quadriplegic after a AAA repair, think about anterior spinal artery syndrome. Essentially, in anterior spinal artery syndrome, all the pathways in the spinal cord are knocked out, with the exception of the dorsal column medial lemniscus system. So those people will have like, you know, they won't have any issues with like sensing, fine touch, vibration and proprioception, but they will absolutely have issues with every other thing, like pain and temperature from the upper and lower extremities. They'll have issues with like upper motor neuron and lower motor neuron, like signs and like findings, right, for the spinal cord, because everything has effectively been wiped out. And then one other thing you may see on your exam is they may describe a question about a patient that has had a AAA repair, and then they tell you that this patient over the last 2-3 months, you know, their hemoglobin has been dropping, And in addition to their hemoglobin dropping, they tell you that they have hemocult positive stools. If you see that, what are you thinking about on your exam? Well, I would really hope under those circumstances you are thinking about the development of an aortoenteric fistula. Okay, an aortoenteric fistula. So a fistula is formed between the aorta, the triple E that has been fixed, and the GI tract, right? So those people are chronically losing blood into the GI tract. That's why they can have like an iron deficiency anemia. Now, last complication you should know about a AAA, right? Especially if they tell you that, oh, you know, this person's AAA was fixed a few months ago or a few weeks ago. And they are noticing that, you know, they are doing like CT angiography and they are seeing like contrast go beyond the contours of the aneurysm that was just excluded. If you see that, think about a complication known as an endoleak, okay? A complication known as an endoleak. It just means that you did not properly exclude the aneurysm. So things are still able to enter the aneurysm from the stent that you placed in the person's abdominal aorta. So again, that's something high yield you want to keep at the back of your mind on exams. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and this patient, you know, maybe recently had like an orthopedic procedure and, or has been bedbound in the hospital for a long time for like whatever reason. If you see that and let's say they start complaining of like severe unilateral leg pain and swelling and tenderness and everything, under those circumstances, you really want to think about a DVT, right? And remember, right, a DVT, the things that predispose you to DVT, a varicose triad, right? Remember, a varicose triad is best remembered by using the mnemonic SHE, right? So remember that the S stands for, like stasis, right? So being bedbound. The H stands for hypercoagulability, right? And then the E stands for endothelial dysfunction. So whenever you have those situations, right, when a person is bedbound, then they can have those predisposing conditions that can increase their risk for having a DVT, right? And again, to diagnose a DVT, right, obviously you go ahead and do like a duplex scan of that person's lower extremity. And then after doing the duplex scan, you need to place the person on heparin, right? You need to place the person on heparin. If, for example, the person has like very high bleeding risk and you cannot give them heparin, then the thing you can consider doing on your MBME exam is to place an IVC filter, right? Because that will protect the DVT from converting to a PE under those circumstances. Now, I realize this is a rapid review podcast. Okay, let me just see some last, you know, real quick things and then I'll be done. What if they give you a question about a patient that has chest pain, right? Patient that has chest pain, and then they tell you that, you know, you see an EKG, ST elevations everywhere, and then it's like radiating, they have like the chest pain radiating to the jaw. Obviously, right, this person has a STEMI, right? So this person obviously has one of the acute coronary syndromes. And remember that there are only three types of acute coronary syndromes on MBME exams. The first one is unstable angina, okay? The second one is an NSTEMI, and the third one is a STEMI. In unstable angina, you don't have like any ST elevations, you don't have any troponin elevations. In an NSTEMI, you don't have any ST elevations, but you have troponin elevations. In a STEMI, you have ST segment elevations or like a new left bundle branch block and you have elevated troponins, okay? That's how you differentiate between those three types of acute coronary syndromes. And the thing is, when a person has any kind of acute coronary syndrome, right, your next step in management is always coronary angiography, okay? I'll just go ahead and throw that out there. If a person has unstable angina, you absolutely have no business trying to do a stress test for those people. They are too high risk. Because the thing is, if a person has unstable angina and they have a negative stress test, you're still likely to want to pursue coronary angiography under those circumstances because you cannot be sure. So that's why once you have an acute coronary syndrome, you've bought yourself a coronary angiogram. On the other hand, if a person does not have an acute coronary syndrome, like stable angina, for example, then those people do not need to pursue the those people do not need coronary angiography. Stable angina, you can go ahead and get a stress test, okay? And remember, with your stress test, right, if a person has a pre-existing EKG abnormality, then you cannot do any kind of EKG-based stress test. Your stress tests have to devolve into echocardiogram-based stress tests. And remember, right, you can use exercise. If a person can exercise, they should exercise, because that actually gives you a lot more information with regards to stress tests. But obviously, if the person has like severe osteoarthritis, or they are severely obese and they cannot exercise, then you can consider pharmacology, right? And for pharmacology, remember, you use adenosine derivatives like apadenosine, regadenosine, and things of that nature. You can also use dipyridamole, right? But you are essentially taking advantage of the coronary steel principle under those circumstances, again, which I have explained ad nauseum in many podcasts. But remember, you cannot use the adenosine analogs if the patient has a history of reactive airway disease, right? So like bad asthma or bad COPD. Can do that under those circumstances. You can also do a dobutamine stress test, right? A dobutamine stress test. Remember, dobutamine is a beta 1 agonist. But remember that if a person has like a history of like severe like ventricular arrhythmias, then under those circumstances, doing a dobutamine based stress test, beta 1 agonist is probably not the smartest thing in the world. Okay. Now, what is the most common cause of death in the first 24 hours after an MI? That's VFib, right? Remember that after an MI, a person can also get pericarditis, right? They can get pericarditis within the first few days, which is known as fibrinous pericarditis. Or remember that they can get pericarditis like, you know, a couple of weeks after the MI episode, right? That's an autoimmune phenomenon, right? Remember, that's what's known as Dressler syndrome, okay? Dressler syndrome. So keep that at the back of your mind on exams. And remember, right, obviously, if a person has pericarditis, the classic findings on EKG will be the classic diffuse, like non-territorial ST segment elevations, and then they will also have correspondent PR segment depressions, okay? So again, that's something high yield to keep at the back of your mind. And pericarditis, right, will obviously present as chest pain that is worse with inspiration, right? Or they will tell you that the person's chest pain is worse when they lie back, or better when they sit up, right? If you see like chest pain that's better when people sit up, right, then you really want to think about pericarditis under those circumstances. And if a person has pericarditis, really, right, like your first step in management is to give an NSAID, right? If the NSAIDs are not cutting it, you can add you can give a steroid. If the steroids are not cutting it, you can give colchicine. Remember, if a person has renal failure, then your only option, the only option remaining to you is to give steroids, okay? Because colchicine and NSAIDs can torch a person's kidneys relatively quickly, okay? So if a person has renal failure, you probably should consider not using any of those agents. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient? You know, this patient has been having palpitations, 25-year-old guy, and then on EKG, you notice that the PR segment is short and the QRS complex is wide, and the person has a delta wave. What are you thinking about? I will say under those circumstances, you're probably thinking about WPW, right? So Wolff Parkinson White. Remember, the pathophysiology of WPW is that you have like this bundle of Kent that allows direct communication between the atria and the ventricles, okay? So direct communication between the atria and the ventricles through the bundle of Kent, right? And that can cause us some serious problems. So under those circumstances, if a person has WPW, you know, they will try to trick you into giving like beta blockers or whatever. You can do that. You cannot give an AV nodal blocking agent in a person that has WPW, because that will actually like make things worse, right? So typically, when a person has WPW, the drug of choice is a class 1A antiarrhythmic known as procainamide, okay? It's a class 1A antiarrhythmic, right? Procainamide. And remember that procainamide is also associated with drug-induced lupus, right? With those fancy-schmancy antihistone antibodies. So that's something you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. And WPW, just as a rule, short PR interval, delta wave, stuff like that, right? So again, all high-yield things to keep in mind that you treat with procainamide. And then, what if you get a question about a patient, and this patient, you know, complains of like severe leg pain. She says it's worse at the end of the day, and it's better when she wakes up in the morning. And then they tell you that you notice that she has like a painless ulcer above her medial malleolus. What are you thinking about under those circumstances? Well, I would really hope that you're thinking about like chronic venous insufficiency. Really, the way you made that diagnosis is, you know, you do like some kind of duplex scan of the lower extremities. And the buzzword pathophysiology you want to remember on your exam is incompetence of venous valves, okay? Incompetence of venous valves. That is the general pathophysiology behind chronic venous insufficiency. Now, when a person has chronic venous insufficiency, right, they tend to get ulcers above the medial malleolus, right? That's something very high yield to remember and understand. Okay, that's something very high yield to remember and understand. I mean, that, and the thing is, all that blood that's pulling in those people's legs, right, that can cause like something called stasis dermatitis. Okay, that can cause something called a stasis dermatitis. And really, the way you treat chronic venous insufficiency is just tell the patient to elevate their legs, right? Tell them to elevate their legs. And they can also wear like compression socks and compression boots. There are some boots known as UNA boots, UNNA. Okay, they work pretty well for, they work you know, pretty well for treating the condition. So again, those are all high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind on exams. And usually venous ulcers, right? So these like ulcers above the medial malleolus, they tend to be non-purulent, okay? They tend to be non-purulent, and they tend, actually they can be purulent, I take that back. The thing I wanted to say is that they tend to be not painful, okay? So venous ulcers are usually not painful on MBME exams. And then VTAC is the last thing I want to talk about, right? So if they give you a question about a patient that has like a wide complex regular tachyarrhythmia, obviously under those circumstances, you want to think about VTAC. Remember that VTAC, there are only three decisions you need to make on your exam, right? If a patient with VTAC has a pulse, you have two decisions to make. If a patient with VTAC has no pulse, well, you don't have many decisions to make. You just go ahead and activate So if a person has VTAC, no pulse, you give the person unsynchronized cardioversion, also called defibrillation. But if the patient has a pulse and they have VTAC, the things you need to think about is, are they hemodynamically stable? If they're hemodynamically stable, your next step really is to give them amiodarone. But if they're hemodynamically unstable, right, then your next step is to perform something called a synchronized cardioversion. Remember, your friends at the MBME, they have many names for synchronized cardioversion, right? So things like direct current cardioversion, direct current countershock, those all mean one and the same thing. So again, all high yield things to keep at the back of your mind for exams. So I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here. I feel like I've gone on for long enough. This is almost 50 minutes. As I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams. Step one. Step 2 CK, Step 3, Step 2 CS, preclinical med school exams, third-year shelf exams. If you're a medicine resident, I tutor for the ABIA main training exam and the board exam. And then if you're a college student, I tutor like Gen Chem, O-Chem, Physics, Biochem, Histology, and Physiology. And then I also do this thing called longitudinal tutoring, where if you're a first, second, or third-year medical student, I tutor you for your class exam, so like your shelf exams, and then at the same time I tutor you for the upcoming USMLE exam you have. Again, I've done this with a lot of people, right, and many of the people that have done this have found it to be like very successful for them. And then the final thing, I guess one of the final things I offer, is like the USMLE booster course is 10 hours for step 2 CQ or step 3 and 20 hours for step 1. It's something you do at the end of your dedicated period, or when you feel like you're, you know, your knowledge base is decent and you need someone to put everything together for you. I do those booster courses to essentially, you know, integrate things together in a high yield format and talk about most of the high yield concepts that's likely to be tested on the exam. Okay, so that's what the role that's served by those booster courses. And then if you're a med student applying to residency, right, so like an ERAS application, or a college student applying to like med school, right? So, okay, sorry, I said med student applying to med school. No, med student applying to residency, so ERAS application, or college student applying to med school, so like an AMCAS application. I do offer like one-on-one advising, coaching, consulting for that. So like personal statements, rec letters, editing applications, mock interviews. I've worked with, again, tons and tons of people on that. And again, the overwhelming majority of the people I've worked with have matched at their first choice. And I also have, experience, right, on the admissions committee of a top 2 med school for a long time. So I've, again, read thousands of high-quality applications. So if that's something you're interested in, if you're interested in any of these things, either reach out to me through the website or send me an email at divineinterventionpodcasts@gmail.com. So do have a wonderful rest of your day, and congratulations to the WNBA champions, the Washington Mystics. They did a fantastic job. I was particularly impressed with Deladon and my Belgian Dynamite, Emma Missaman. So I do love basketball, if you've not noticed, and I'm a Laker fan, for those people that are wondering. So I will see you later. Have a wonderful rest of your day. I hope to churn out more podcasts within the next couple of hours. So I'll see you next time. God bless you. Thank you.